This is the World Affairs Council of Hilton Head with a speech by H.R. McMaster entitled Battlegrounds, the Fights to Defend the Free World. This is given on April 24th, 2020 by Zoom webinar.
Good morning. Our speaker today is a man of many personas. He is a warrior. Witnessed the Battle of 73 Easting during Desert Storm as commander of Troop E of the 2nd Armored Cav Regiment, and several years later as regimental commander of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment and the pacification of Tal Afar in Iraq. He is an academic and an author. He has a PhD in history from North Carolina, and his first book, Dereliction of Duty, is a sharp criticism of the senior civilian and military leadership during our war, Vietnam. A military intellectual, he was a leading member of the coterie of colonels who redefined our counterinsurgency strategy for successful implementation during the surge in Iraq. A military futurist, a designer of the future U.S. Army. So he was looking at what comes after, what comes next. While serving as the Deputy Commanding General of Training and Doctrine Command of the U.S. Army. And this has resulted in the creation of the U.S. Army Futures Command for its implementation, an advisor to presidents, and now a full circle return to academic and author. He serves as the Michel Antoine Djamy Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute and Stanford University, and the Bernard and Susan Liotard Fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute and a lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. With the pending book, Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World, coming this fall, and it is available now on pre-order from your favorite bookseller. So I give you H.R. McMaster, Lieutenant General retired.
Hey, thanks so much, Lee, and thanks to John and Maureen and to all of you for the privilege of being with you. And, of course, I hope that all of your families are well, that you're doing well and staying healthy in this challenging time. But it's a real privilege to be with you, and I just want to say congratulations to all of you who are members of the World Affairs Council. I think it is more important than ever for Americans to think and discuss the greatest challenges to national security and key foreign policy issues. I think that those citizens like yourselves who are informed about these issues are also those who are going to reverse, I think, the polarization in our society and bring us together. And so we can have respectful, meaningful discussions about the greatest challenges to our authority, our prosperity, and American influence in the world. I think that we are in a crisis situation now, a health crisis, but I know all of us are heartened by these heroes that we see, our first responders and our healthcare workers, and I know that all of us have probably witnessed people coming together in our communities to support each other, and so I'm hoping that this can be a moment in our history that will galvanize us toward really reinforcing our confidence in who we are as a people and our democratic institutions and our principles and processes. So it's great to be with you. I thought what I might do is just talk with you about how I see America's place in the world and what are the greatest challenges are to our national and international security, and do so by really recounting how I came into the job as National Security Advisor, how we established priorities to really shift our foreign policy in some critical areas, and then to talk about some of those challenges. Well, I really had a great privilege of serving in our Army for 34 years, as Lee mentioned. And I believe that in our Army, I had the opportunity to bear witness to the end of an era and the beginning of a new era. And in November of 1989, Eagle Troop of the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment was patrolling the East-West German border at a town near Coburg. This is the town where Martin Luther translated the Bible into German. It's the birthplace of Hans Morgenthau, who was sort of the father of the school of, of international relations as he joined the faculty at the University of Chicago. And on that day in November, the East German Politburo official lifted travel restrictions to the West, almost by mistake. And as he did that, our soldiers, our cavalry troopers, went from staring down East German border guards to witnessing those border guards opening the gates as hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of East Germans poured into West Germany. And so our soldiers were swarmed by East Germans bearing bouquets of flowers and bottles of wine. There were hugs, there were tears of joy. And so we saw this artificial barrier that had separated the German people, that had been a really critical part of the Iron Curtain, disappear. And it was in this period of time, I believe, that we began to gain confidence, really confidence in our the primacy and victory of our democratic and our free and open societies over closed authoritarian systems. The Soviet Union collapsed. We won the Cold War. And then almost exactly a year later, that same cavalry troop, and maybe as the commander, as a 28-year-old captain, deployed to Saudi Arabia after Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait in August August of 1990. And we prepared for what would be an offensive operation to liberate Kuwait. We attacked into Kuwait, into Iraq, I'm sorry, on the 24th of February of 1991. And we're the vanguard, the lead element of the so-called left hook into Kuwait. When we're still in Iraq, as we turn due east, we encountered the Republican Guard in defensive positions. And our cavalry troop of 9 tanks and 13 Bradleys rapidly overwhelmed this enemy. And in a 23-minute battle, we destroyed a brigade of the enemy and suffered no casualties. And that was in a lopsided battle, in a larger lopsided victory, in a war that was a lopsided military victory. And I think these two events, the end of the Cold War and this lopsided military victory in Desert Storm, bolstered our confidence even further. And in the 1990s, also during a decade of sustained economic growth, I think some assumptions crept in that underpinned our foreign policy really almost the next decade and a half. And those assumptions had to do with the belief that an arc of history had guaranteed the primacy of our free and open societies over closed authoritarian systems. There was an associated assumption that the great power competition was a relic of the past. And that lopsided military victory also bolstered confidence in the American military's technological prowess. It was during this period of time that this sort of orthodoxy crept in to many defense thinkers. And under the moniker of the Revolution in Military Affairs, or the RMA, and this was the belief that because of America's technological military prowess, future wars, if anyone even had the temerity to challenge the United States, could be waged quickly, cheaply, efficiently, decisively. What crept into the language were terms like rapid decisive operations, right? So who's going to be against that? I mean, if you are you for ponderous, indecisive operations? But what what these concepts did, and the words associated with them, everything was dominance, right? We're going to have dominant battle space knowledge. We're going to have full spectrum dominance over our enemies. It created this expectation that our enemies would fight us the same way that Saddam Hussein did. And as my friend Conrad Crane has observed, there are really two ways to fight the U.S. military: asymmetrically and stupidly. And of course, our enemies learned from Desert Storm and chose to fight us asymmetrically. And tragically, on September 11th, 2001, we saw a terrorist organization had declared war on the United States in the 1990s and actually already had attempted a bombing of the and committed a truck bombing of the Twin Towers years earlier, attack our country with airplanes and box cutters and terrorists. And so we began to experience this first strategic shock that kind of woke us up out of this period of overconfidence. And you might say that overconfidence even translated into some a degree of complacency about critical competitions that were still ongoing in the world, and might have led to a degree of hubris as well. And so America then goes to war in Afghanistan and then in Iraq. And of course, really what everybody wants to debate all the time is, you know, should we have invaded Iraq? I think a real more fruitful question to debate is, who the heck thought it would be easy? And why did they think it would be easy? And so we have the beginning now, after 9/11, of a series of sort of disappointments, right? We had this unexpected length and difficulties of the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And then, of course, in 2009, we have a financial crisis, and our confidence becomes shaken. And I believe then it was then, around this period of time, that the emotional impetus behind our foreign policy shifted from overconfidence and over-optimism to pessimism and even resignation. And when the Obama administration comes in, the Obama administration defines its policies mainly around the president's opposition to the Iraq war, and mainly based on the belief that American disengagement from these complex problems that's overseas is an unmitigated good. So I believe what these two approaches to foreign policy have in common is what you might call strategic narcissism, which is the tendency to define the world as you would like it to be, rather than the way the world actually is. And whereas you could make the argument, I believe, that the George W. Bush administration was over-optimistic and therefore underappreciated the costs and risks of action, that the Obama administration was overly pessimistic about the degree of American influence, the degree that America had in these complex problem sets, and underappreciated the risk and cost of inaction. So whereas the offensive into Iraq to unseat Saddam Hussein in 2003 is the example, I think, of this overconfidence of the Bush administration. I think the withdrawal out of Iraq in 2011 is an example of the Obama administration's resignation and belief that disengagement is an unmitigated good. You might recall that Vice President Biden called President Obama from Baghdad and said, "Thank you for allowing me to end this goddamn war." Well, guess what? You know, wars don't end when one party decides to disengage. And of course, the war didn't end, because what happened is, with our military and really our diplomatic disengagement from Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq is able to pursues these sectarian policies that alienate the Sunni Arab and Sunni Turkmen populations, that convince those populations that the only way we're going to be able to avoid, you know, evisceration is through some violence. And they come again to regard these jihadist terrorist organizations as patrons and protectors. That sets the condition for Al-Qaeda in Iraq 2.0, ISIS, which by 2014 takes over the territory the size of Great Britain and consolidates its gains there, and begins to generate resources that, as we know, threaten the world with multiple ISIS planned and inspired attacks across a broad region, attempted attacks, and some inspired attacks in the United States. The shoot down of a Russian airliner. I mean, the list is large in terms of recognition that these terrorist organizations, once they control territory and resources, become more and more dangerous. And so in February of 2017, I'm walking down Walnut Street in Philadelphia, my hometown. I'm on my way to the Foreign Policy Research Institute, a small but mighty think tank in Philadelphia. They do actually really great work. If you haven't read Orbis, it's really well put together. journal. It's just hard to get to on the internet. I wish it was more accessible. But I was on my way to brief an assembled group of scholars and policy experts on the findings of a 2-year study that I commissioned when I was in charge of designing the future army. And that study was on Russian new generation warfare. It was Russia's use of disruptive technologies combined with sophisticated campaigns of political subversion oriented on Europe. And the specific study focused on the annexation of Crimea and the invasion of Ukraine. And the idea was that if we understood better what Russia's capabilities are, we would be prepared to deter conflict with Russia or to respond to a threat from Russia in the future and to build countermeasures and new capabilities in our army. Well, on my way to FBRI, my phone rings. It's a partially blocked number from Washington. And it was the deputy chief of staff from the White House asking me to fly to Mar-a-Lago the next day to interview his national security advisor. So it really came out of the blue. And I didn't have much time to prepare. I interviewed on that Sunday, actually flew down that Sunday, interviewed Sunday afternoon, was selected for the job on Monday after awkwardly running into Ambassador Bolton in the men's room on my way to my second interview. And then flew back on Air Force One. I did not live in Philadelphia, in Washington. So they flew me in Ospreys back to my home in Fort Eustis, Virginia. I packed a few things, including some books to take with me, and reported for duty in the White House the next afternoon, Tuesday afternoon. But I was grateful. I was grateful for the career that I had had because I had had the opportunity to do a few things that I think were very relevant to my duties and responsibilities. And I would say first and foremost among those was the opportunity to study history. And to really understand better how to ask the right questions and to really be aware, based on the book I wrote on Vietnam called Dereliction of Duty, about how and why Vietnam became an American war, to understand what are the potential pitfalls in national security decision making and in formulating strategy and policy. And I was also grateful for the opportunity to have served in the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and in particular to be parts of teams that cut across all departments, agencies, and included multinational partners, because it's so important, I think, when you're trying to solve these complex problems or overcome complex challenges, that you bring together an interdepartmental perspective and you bring that perspective to bear on these problems. So it was a whirlwind, a few days, but I really came into the job, as I mentioned, believing that this pendulum had swung, from over-optimism, to pessimism and resignation. We probably needed something in between. And we needed to restore, therefore, our strategic competence. And what I put in place was a process in that first year of the Trump administration to try to overcome or to foreclose on and prevent the pitfalls that I had seen during the Vietnam period. So what were some of those pitfalls and what did we do? Well, first of all, one of those pitfalls was that the process that was in place under George Bundy, which was eerie feeling walking into his old office, having written about that period, and now being in charge of the process that I thought was fundamentally flawed in 1964 to 1965, McGeorge Bundy and others within the administration, Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, and others, determined to give President Lyndon Johnson the advice he wanted. Lyndon Johnson, in that period of time, was basing his decisions on Vietnam primarily on his domestic political priorities, getting elected in own right in 1964 and passing the Great Society legislation in 1965. And he saw Vietnam principally as a danger to those goals. So he turned to Secretary of Defense and he said, I need a strategy that will prevent a debate that poses a stark choice between war and disengagement in Vietnam. And what Secretary McNamara gave him was this strategy of graduated pressure based on this thesis that the threat of force in Vietnam would convince Ho Chi Minh to desist from his support for Vietnamese communists in the South. Now, Joint Chiefs of Staff, many others thought, this is a fundamentally flawed strategy. This isn't good. This isn't going to work. And in fact, two war games that were run in the Pentagon, right during this period of time, these war games ended in 1968, right? They began, you know, theoretically, you know, in 1965 with an influx of troops and the bombing of the North. The last turn in the war game was in 1968. And that last turn ends with 500,000 troops in Vietnam with no clear path to success and the American people losing faith in the effort. These were eerily prophetic war games. But they didn't cause any kind of reexamination of the assumptions on which the policy rested and the strategy rested. And again, that was because Lyndon Johnson, he got the advice he wanted from his advisors. The problem set in Vietnam was not well understood by the key decision makers and the president himself. I mean, the North Vietnamese support for Vietnamese communists in the South was a problem, but it wasn't the only problem. There was an indigenous insurgency in the South that was connected to the government's lack of legitimacy. And so the problem was not well framed and well understood to begin with. The strategy was cooked to give the president the answer he wanted. And there was really no meaningful really debate about alternatives. So when I got to the White House, the first few days, I convened, did all hands meeting with the National Security Council staff. And I talked to them about how we were going to structure the National Security Council decision-making process. And we were going to structure that around initially a session to frame and understand first order challenges to national security on their own terms. And we identified 16 priority national security challenges. Among those were the challenges associated with revisionist powers on the Eurasian landmass, China and Russia, the return of, you know, great power competition. There had been no arc of history that guaranteed the primacy of free and open societies. We were in a competition, but we had not been competitive because we were absent from the arena. So this was one of the first areas of priority. The second area of priority were transnational threats to our security, and in particular, jihadist terrorist organizations. A threat, by the way, that has not gone away, and I think is actually even greater today than it was on September 10th, 2001. And we could talk more about that if you'd like in the Q&A. The third group of challenges were associated with hostile states, and in particular, Iran, and North Korea. And the fourth area were more functional challenges or new arenas of competition that were such as cyber-enabled information warfare instances, as we saw during the 2016 election and really part of a sustained campaign of Russian political subversion aimed at the United States and the West. Threats in cyberspace broadly, threats to space, and then, of course, biomedical threats, which we can talk more about as well. And the threats of naturally occurring pandemic also. So what we did before in these sessions is we had the framing session up front. And the framing session was designed to understand these challenges on their own terms, to identify what vital U.S. interests were at stake, then to view those challenges through the lens of our vital interests to craft overarching goals and more specific objectives. And then importantly, we would identify planning assumptions, especially involving the degree to which we believed we had agency or influence over this problem set. And we being really all the departments and agencies of the U.S. government, all the elements of national power, and then like-minded partners, allies, partner nations, but also partners in the private sector that are so important. To be able to get after some of these challenges and to overcome them. After that framing was designed, first of all, for the president's cabinet to come together, to comment on it, refine it, and approve it to bring to the president. After we did that, after we had that session, I brought the president, called a cabinet memo, and that signaled the change of policy across the government with goals and objectives and planning assumptions. But then also in that session, we received the guidance of the secretaries of state and defense and the heads of the intel agencies and so forth, Treasury, Commerce, you know, an integrated effort across the cabinet. And then the secretary level, they would then generate a draft integrated strategy to overcome obstacles to progress, to take advantage of opportunities to accomplish those the objectives that were defined. And I insisted that those integrated strategies come with multiple options, plural, for the president. And this was based on the belief that we had to do this to avoid what we saw, you know, the kind of the groupthink effect, what I saw from our research on Vietnam. And it's in the exploration of those options that are differentiated by levels of resource and maybe level of risk and amount of time to implement that the president receives best advice, because he can examine advantages and disadvantages to these courses of action and select a course of action that is consistent with the president's agenda. There is a tendency in government, and Peter Rodman writes about this in a book called Presidential Command, there is a tendency to go for lowest common denominator, you know, consensus position. And in the past, I think many times, the National Security Council process was bottom up, right, about these issues. So you get assistant secretary level together, and the topic is Iran. And the guidance they have up front is like, Iran, discuss, right? So they discuss Iran. And what you tend to get, because of the satisfying and lowest common denominator, you get what I would characterize as policy pablum. It's meaningless papers, directionless papers. And so I think this process enabled us to implement fundamental shifts in U.S. foreign policy, many of which were long overdue. And I'll just summarize those quickly, because I really am anxious to hear where you'd like to take the discussion. That shift in policy is available in the highly readable December 2017 National Security Strategy of the United States and at an unclassified level, obviously, but that strategy reflects real integrated strategies, which we can maybe discuss during the Q&A. So run through this quickly. Those big shifts involved a tremendous shift on China policy, which you've seen over the last couple of years. Our policy on China had been based on one of these flawed assumptions that gained a high degree of acceptance in the 1990s. I just wrote an essay in the Atlantic Monthly on this topic. And that assumption was that China, having been welcomed into the international economic and political order, would play by the rules, liberalize its economy, and as it's prospered, would liberalize its form of governance. Well, you know, it's not doing the opposite of that. The Chinese Communist Party is extending and tightening its exclusive grip on power. It is creating an Orwellian police state, a surveillance police state internally. You just saw what it did in Hong Kong, arresting about 15 Hong Kong leaders who have the temerity to make the argument that the Chinese people ought to have a say in how they're governed. It is now again threatening Taiwan directly. You see it subverting international organizations like the World Health Organization. It's doing anything but playing by the rules. It's doubling down on unfair trade and economic practices, industrial espionage. I could go on, obviously. So we shifted from this idea of strategic engagement and the belief that China's Communist Party would become like the Grinch, their hearts would grow two sizes bigger, they'd be fundamentally different. It didn't work. So we shifted to a strategy of competition with China. And you see the elements of that falling into place. We can talk more about that if you'd like. On Russia, the strategy was to really impose costs on Putin far beyond those that he factors in at the beginning of his decision-making, because Putin was getting more and more aggressive, right? And I think he believed that there would be a movement to alleviate sanctions. Well, that didn't happen. We increased sanctions on him, especially after the attempted murder of Skripal and his daughter in the UK, which put hundreds, thousands of people at risk with a banned nerve agent. There was an attack on our forces in Syria in February of 2018, during which we killed well over 200 Russian mercenaries. I mean, the situation was getting worse with Putin. I think Putin has some real problems now, as does China. And we could talk more about that if you'd like. What is the effect of COVID, you know, of the depressed oil prices, on the slowdown of the global economy, on each of these geostrategic competitions? So we decided, hey, we have to compete with these revisionist powers on the Eurasian landmass. For jihadist terrorist organizations, we believe that we need to sustain our efforts overseas. There is really, in my view, there is no way to defend ourselves, you know, at the water's edge against these enemies who are determined to commit mass murder of innocents as their principal tactic in a war against all humanity. And so we could talk more about that as well. And then on rogue states and hostile states, North Korea and Iran, we implemented strategies of maximum pressure. It's very dynamic situations in both cases there. So I'll just maybe address that quick in Q&A if you'd like. And then in cyberspace and space's competitive domains, we made some shifts. You may have seen this with the Vice President's Space Council and the work that's ongoing there. And then also shifts in policy. Okay, can you hear me again, you guys?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, something happened there. I don't know what that was, but hopefully everybody's still with us.
You are, along with around 240 other people.
Okay, all right, great. Okay, so let me just move to wrap this up here, because I really think that the shift was significant because it helped us restore our strategic competence. Now, the problem is, I think the problem that we're facing right now, it's a nonpartisan problem. The problem is, I think there is a growth of a neo-isolationist movement in the United States that really cuts across the political spectrum. Like you have the billionaires George Soros and Charles Koch coming together to fund new think tanks, which essentially are arguing for America's disengagement from overseas commitments as an unmitigated good. Now, George Soros and Charles Koch have very little in common politically except that belief. And that belief, I think, as I mentioned at the beginning, is based on this strategic narcissism, the belief that what we do is going to be decisive to the outcome. And as a result, we don't give a degree of agency and influence to the other, including our adversaries. And so what's really important, I think, for us to cultivate is strategic empathy, to be able to view really these challenges from the perspective of the other and to understand better, especially what are the emotions and aspirations and ideologies that drive and constrain the other. We do, I think, as part of this strategic narcissism, we're prone to wishful thinking, you know, whether it's under the George W. Bush administration in terms of really overconfidence and underappreciation of the risk of inaction, or whether it's under the Obama administration with an underappreciation of the risk of inaction. I think now you see with the negotiation in Afghanistan, as well as the desire, right, just to pull out of Syria, although that hasn't happened yet, the belief that we can determine the future course of events based on what we do. But I would just say that the United States has to deal with really determined adversaries. And to do so, we have to compete much more effectively. So I'll stop there. I'm really anxious to hear where you'd like to take the conversation. In the book Battlegrounds, I do go into some depth on the history of how these challenges developed. And then make recommendations about how we can protect the security and interests of the American people and our way of life, as well as promote American prosperity and extend American influence and the influence of our free, open, and democratic societies. So thanks for the privilege of being with you, and I'm anxious to hear where you'd like to take the conversation.
Okay, thank you. I would like to call your attention to the fact that if you move your cursor to the bottom of the view screen, you'll see a bar pop up. Right about in the middle of that is something that says Q&A. We've already got a couple of people who have found that and submitted a couple of questions. In fact, I'm going to refer to one of them right now. It's a combination request and question. This is from a retired ambassador living here on Hilton Head, and he refers to the recent article on China in the Atlantic. And I'll read it. It says, in that article, you propose soft power plus targeted sanctions. I recognize those are sensible means, but what are the ends and the ways for that? And what is the risk if soft power isn't just enough? Second part is, how would you respond to a more aggressive China, for example, in the South China Sea? And now for the request. He said, please give my regards to Condoleezza Rice, my old boss at the NSC staff and state. And that's actually from Greg Schulte, retired ambassador.
Hey, well, that's a great question. Boy, it really is probably with Secretary Rice here and my other colleagues at Hoover. It's just, it is a wonderful place to be with tremendous students as well as colleagues here. For those of you who want to tune in, we have a discussion that's kind of fun, with Neil Ferguson and John Cochran called Goodfellows. It airs once a week, and you can find it easily on the internet. But it's a way to get acquainted with Hoover, and then Secretary Rice just last week did an excellent interview. It's also on the Hoover website on the geopolitical implications of the COVID-19 crisis. But so here's what I would say, Ambassador, and to all of you is that. It was actually our complacency with China, our belief that that welcoming China into the World Trading Organization, welcoming China to international organizations, would lead to the moderation of their behavior that I think put us on a path to confrontation. I think China was emboldened. It's pretty clear that they're emboldened in this, if you'll forgive the term, land grab in the South China Sea to control the. To control the sea lanes through which one third of the world's surface trade flows, I think that competition is the best way to avoid confrontation. And by the way, it doesn't foreclose on cooperation in areas where we really ought to be able to work together. So I think that it's soft power, but as you're alluding to with the question on the South China Sea. It's also the ability to deter China, for China to recognize the Chinese. And when I say China, I really mean the Chinese Communist Party, right? China is not monolithic or homogeneous, and that's really where we have the problem, is the policies of the Chinese Communist Party. And I believe that China has to be deterred by denial, which is the old deterrence theory of convincing your potential enemy. That potential enemy cannot accomplish his objectives through the use of force. And so what you've seen in the South China Sea is a sustained naval deployment, but really a sustained multinational naval deployment. We used to make a big deal, these big freedom of navigation exercises, running through the South China Sea. They're just done routinely now, and they're done on a multinational base. Japan is France. UK, Australia, and I think what's happening is China's overplaying their hand right now in the South China Sea. You just saw the harassment of the Malaysian naval vessels there in the South China Sea the last couple of days. You've seen the infringement of Taiwan airspace, threatening moves toward Taiwan. These are all eliciting, I think, greater support for the U.S. and other like-minded countries in support of the free and open Indo-Pacific. Policy and strategy. In terms of other forms of competition, I call it sharp more than soft power. Enforcement mechanisms, tariffs is part of that. But I think what's happening is costs are being imposed on China based on free market forces. the way that China treats companies that have to do business with them, forcing the transfer of intellectual property, forcing the transfer of sensitive technologies, privileging their state-owned enterprises, over the free market internally, overproducing goods at artificially low prices, dumping them on the global market to drive U.S. and other companies out of business and workers out of jobs. The harassment now of foreigners living in China. I mean, look what they're doing with African residents in China right now. Pre-COVID, companies were coming to the conclusion it's not good to do business in China. It may not be worth it to gain access to the Chinese market anymore. And now we're seeing, of course, the vulnerability of supply chains that are overly dependent on China. And with the COVID crisis as well, with the actions of the Chinese Communist Party, right, punishing the doctors that are trying to that are trying to raise concerns about this, shutting off internal travel, but not shutting off international travel. Why did you do that, Xi Jinping? So I think that there is increasingly a recognition that the company's interests are decoupling. We're in a decoupling competition now, I think. And China, as you've seen with their, with this kind of ham-handed information campaign, disinformation, propaganda campaign internationally, where they're trying to cover their tracks and responsibility for this crisis by sending defective masks and medical equipment to people and publicizing it, that's eliciting an even more negative response. And I'm not just saying just in the United States, where a recent poll said 2/3 of the American people. Okay. All right, can you guys still hear me? Sorry. Can you hear me okay? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, sorry. So you saw in Germany presented the Chinese Communist Party with a $130 billion bill. You see press reactions across Europe. You see responses in Africa and other regions now to this debt trap under One Belt One Road that China is setting for vulnerable countries. The dissatisfaction associated with China's export of their authoritarian model and the surveillance state technologies to other countries. So, Ambassador, I'm pretty optimistic. I think it's more than just soft power. It's deterrence by denial. It's working multilaterally. I think everything we do to confront the aggression of China, the economic aggression in particular, should be done with Japan, the EU, UK in particular. And I think you're going to see more and more of that cooperation. As you did, look, December 2018, the U.S. Department of Justice, by the way, I think is doing a wonderful job on the China problem set right now. In December 2018, you had 15 countries simultaneously engage in indictments and sanctions against APT-10, which is the Chinese cyber industrial espionage and hacking cell. So I really feel good. I mean, the whole world's got to get through this crisis. But I think on the back end, the conventional wisdom is, I don't know if you saw the front page of The Economist, hey, is China winning? I think the answer to that is heck no, they're not winning. And in fact, on the back end of this, we should focus on ourselves, strengthen our democracies, strengthen our free market economies, ensure equality of opportunity, restore faith in our democratic principles, institutions, processes, but at the same time as well, defend against the China's sophisticated campaign against being open societies. I think you're muted still.
Okay.
John, you're muted.
Yeah, I got it. We have a question here asking you to elaborate on the current relationship between Russia and China. So would you please address that?
There's a strategic partnership, it's called, and what they've said, they will not oppose each other under circumstances, that they're going to work together. Of course, this is not good because going back to the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, geostrategic theorists like Mackinder said, They don't want any one power to dominate the world island of the Eurasian landmass. And of course, you have these two countries cooperating with each other who are authoritarians, both of whom are undermining our free market economic systems and our democratic governments. So it would be good at some point, right? It would be good at some point to restore, you know, the triangular diplomacy of the Nixon Kissinger period, where with the opening to China in the 1970s, the idea was that the United States would have a closer relationship each with China and with Russia than they had with each other. I don't think that's possible with Xi Jinping in power and with Vladimir Putin in power, but it is possible to restore that kind of an approach in the future. I don't think that China and Russia are natural allies. Russia now, as you know, they have some real problems in growing and diversifying their economy. They're over reliant on energy, and the bottom's fallen out of that market. Russia is in a very, very, very difficult position economically, and Putin is in a difficult position politically as a result. Remember, there was a great deal of opposition to him. There were mass arrests. Some people were killed in protests just a few months ago when Putin tried to restrict who could run for municipal office in Moscow. That discontent has been growing, associated with the stagnating economy within Russia. But now I think increasingly it's going to be with COVID and what will likely be a Russian healthcare system and infrastructure that's not up to the task, especially in the rural areas. You combine that now with the bottom falling out of the oil market, and the Russian people, I think, are bound to question what the heck is Russia doing in Syria, enabling, you know, the destruction of a state, and then they're going to be stuck with the bill, right? I mean, Russia's going around the Middle East trying to say, hey, you know, Saudi Arabia, UAE, we write a check, you know, for to reconstruct the country. You know, we just helped Assad and the Iranians destroy it. Well, I think the answer ought to be heck no, right? Saudi Arabia's not going to have the money to do it anyway now, based on the oil markets. And Russians are also asking about, you know, what is Russia doing in Venezuela and underwriting the Maduro regime? And in fact, just in the last week or so, bailing out Rosneft, you know, the state oil company, to the tune of $4.1 billion, right? That could have been spent in Russia. So I think Putin is going to be in a really tense position politically. And of course, you don't want to underestimate him, right? Because he's at top of percent what is a protection racket, because he has dirt on everybody there. And the criminalized patron system that he runs, you know, there are a lot of people who are interested in perpetuating that because that's kind of the gravy train. But I think that what's good about Russia is, you know, in Russia, elections still matter. Because if the election didn't matter, Putin wouldn't spend so much energy trying to rig the elections, right? So I think that could be a political change in Russia that could hopefully, you know, who knows what could happen. It could be worse, right? But it could result in a change in government, a change maybe in the relative influence of Putin and others, in which leaders in Russia could come to the fore who see their future more with Europe and the West than with China. I don't think Russia wants to be China's gas station, right? Where China, you know, under Made in China 2025, wants to dominate advanced manufacturing, and what China wants is, you know, they want raw material and energy from Russia. Russia has a lot of space, right? Not a lot of people. You know, China has a lot of people and could move into that space. You know, historically there have been you know, huge tensions along the border there. All of those could come back to the fore. So I guess I'm sorry I'm going on about this, but I'll just say, okay, right now prospects are not good in terms of separating those two from their strategic partnership, but that, I don't think that's going to hold true going into the future.
Okay, we've got a couple of related regional questions. I'll go ahead and combine those. One is, where is Kim Jong-un? And does it matter? And what is North Korea up to?
Right. Okay, so we don't know where Kim Jong-un is. I don't think. You know, I don't think he's dead. You know, I don't know what his medical condition is. I think it's pretty clear he's not dead, or at least that's what the reporting is. But we have to remember, you know, when Kim died, even that only about five people knew, right? When Kim Jong-il died, it wasn't known for like a week, right? So you know, it's really an opaque view of into the North Korean elite that the world has, right? So it does matter. It does matter because, you know, this is now a third generation brutal dictatorship that rests on really almost a farcical ideology, this Juche ideology, in which the Kim family has turned destitution into a virtue and a symbol of the North Korean race's purity and so forth. I mean, how long are the North Korean people, you know, going to buy that, right? If you remember back in 96, there were rumors anyway, some evidence that an army corps had revolted during the famine in 96. North Korea is under tremendous pressure now. They're under tremendous pressure because of the campaign of maximum pressure to impose and enforce sanctions on them for their nuclear and missile programs. But the best enforcer of maximum pressure has been COVID-19 and the shutdown of the border with China. There are signs now that the Pyongyang elite are binge buying within Pyongyang. This is a new dynamic, even that there is a Pyongyang elite. This is sort of an emerging middle class who has been able to, based on their complicity with the regime, has been able to improve their quality of life. So they have a stake in not seeing that quality of life decrease. And so that's an important dynamic, I think, to watch in the North. And what they're up to, you know, what they're up to is really, you know, trying to create a crisis again to get back to the failed pattern of previous efforts at denuclearization. And so actually, year to date, North Korea has fired more missiles than they have in any other year. Now, a lot of us have missed that, right? Because we're in the midst of a health crisis, global health crisis. But what Kim Jong-un wants to do is he wants to get back to what's worked for them. You know, especially at least going back to the agreed framework in 1994, where they commit a provocation, and then what they do is they coerce the illicit sort of concessions and direct payoffs just to get into a negotiation with them. And then, of course, once you're in the negotiation, it's a long, strung out, frustrating negotiation that ends, you know, in a weak agreement that locks in the status quo as the new normal, and then North Korea violates that agreement with another provocation and repeats the cycle. Well, I think what the Trump administration decided, you know, when I was there and has held to this, is the definition of insanity attributed to Einstein, maybe falsely, you know, of doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Let's not do that. And so the campaign and the strategy of maximum pressure, this multinational effort, is an effort to convince Kim Jong-un that he is safer, not just from external, right, but from internal. He's internal threats to his regime. He is safer without nuclear weapons than he is with them. And that, of course, involves, you know, security guarantees and everything. But, of course, you know, that's kind of a false issue, right? I mean, every act of aggression since June 1950 on the peninsula has been initiated by the North, right? So I think, you know, I think it's a really critical dynamic now. And it's a dynamic that also involves South Korea, which just had legislative elections and for the National Assembly. And President Moon's party won big, which is kind of a reconciliation party. There's an alliance dynamic now because the Trump administration is asking, you know, for more burden sharing, for create a significant increase in an offer. Trump administration has not taken that offer yet. So that, there are tensions within the relationship. What I'm concerned about is, could there be a perfect storm, essentially, of an interaction between President Moon's political base and President Trump's political base, a portion of which is part of kind of this neo-isolationist sentiment. So it's an extraordinarily dynamic situation now. You see North Korea with even more aggressive rhetoric, you know, and all right, can you hear me, John?
I see your name pop back up, but don't yet see you.
Okay, all right, well, I'm ready for a question.
We can hear him.
I'll reappear.
Okay, if you're able to hear us, we can hear you.
Sure.
Okay, I've got another question, and it refers to your upcoming book, Battlegrounds. Based on what you have seen in the last 3+ years with respect to America's leadership, standing, and reputation worldwide, would you please comment on the effect on our relationships with important allies, principal adversaries, and those who may have expressed concern about the fact we've withdrawn from a lot of multinational agreements?
High degree of international cooperation going on below the surface of what's reported. There are tensions, as you know, that are those tensions are really having to do with demands for burden sharing. Demands for burden sharing within alliances is not new, as probably many of you know. I mean, that goes back to the 1970s. What concerns me oftentimes is more the tone, right? The tone of public discourse among allies, I think, is unfortunate at times. But I really feel as if the relationships are still very strong. At least when I was National Security Advisor, we worked very, very closely with key allies and partners on critical issues and so what do we have to do going forward, I guess, is the question, to increase American influence, as you mentioned, within international organizations, but also bilateral and key alliance relationships. I think that this is really a clarifying moment for all of us. I think the relationship with Europe is really important, and I think strong Europe is in U.S. interest, right? There's this idea that Europe is an economic competitor, and maybe they'd be better off divided, than they are together. I think that's problematic, because obviously that redounds to the benefit of Russia and China and other other competitors, right? Those who might be hostile to U.S. interests. What binds us to Europe? I think we ought to emphasize what that is. I mean, it's really our democratic principles, our faith in democratic institutions and processes and rule of law and freedom of speech and religious tolerance. And I mean, these are important ideas because they are so contested these days, by revisionist powers, by authoritarian powers, by jihadist terrorist organizations. And so I think it's immensely important for us to maintain those relationships. As you know, problems internal to Europe didn't start with Donald Trump, right? I mean, these are problems that predated President Trump, and Europe has to work hard at resolving these issues. I think what the European Central Bank is doing, the role that Germany and France are playing in assisting countries that are hardest hit by this, especially Italy and Spain, I think that's going to be really important. And I hope what happens is that a consensus occurs in Europe that about what binds them together, and maybe a reevaluation of what the role of the EU is. I think maybe the EU lost its focus on what it should have been from the beginning, and maybe this is an opportunity to strengthen it, as well as to reach out to sort of the newer democracies, some of which are beset by an interaction between the favoring of nationalism versus the supranationalism that binds them to Europe. And some of these nationalist movements that that are Euroskeptic. I'm thinking, of course, of Hungary as an example of this. So I think that there's a lot of work to do here diplomatically, obviously, and economically now on the back end of this crisis. But what I'm hoping is that this crisis will bring us closer together. I think some of our relationships are much stronger than they have been in the past. I think the U.S.-Japan relationship, I think it's as strong as ever, really. I think a lot of our relationships in the Western Hemisphere are extraordinarily strong as well. There are going to be tensions, I think, with Mexico, with the new president's policies. I mean, I think what Mexico is doing economically is the opposite of what really everybody else is doing, right? The austerity versus fiscal stimulus. And this is based on President López Obrador's, really not anti-business, but, business skeptical, at least, or anti-business kind of sentiments, right? And I think that it's going to really create problems for Mexico, right? Mexico is important to us for our security because they're on our border. We've had a great relationship with them in the past. And if we want to succeed and we want to address issues like with migration and everything else, we need Mexico to succeed for that. And of course, oil prices, tourism. Those are big sectors in the Mexican economy, hit really hard. But there are opportunities, I think, with the rethinking of supply chains and potentially, the ability for manufacturing to be reinforced in Mexico as we transition to the USMCA, the follow-on to NAFTA and so forth. In international organizations, so alliances ought to be strengthened across the board. Cooperative relationships, partnerships, are going to be immensely important going forward on the back end of this crisis. Some international organizations have been subverted, by competitors, by China, by authoritarian regimes. You've seen that within the World Health Organization. You see that in the Human Rights Council. I mean, the Human Rights Council prevents human rights activists from even visiting them, in New York. I mean, it's a rogues gallery of members within the Human Rights Council, UNESCO, similarly. So it's really always, it's really a debate, right? Of what do you do if an international organization is subverted by authoritarians who are actually opposed to the very purpose of that organization, as we saw with the World Health Organization's behavior. Is the best course of action to withdraw from it and just cut your losses, or to compete within it? I think in most cases, it's to compete within it. And I think the withholding of funding for the WHO could be a very positive thing. It's not affecting what they're doing right now, but there ought to be an investigation of what happened, and the United States has to exert their influence. I would just say in general, there is no prize for membership in an international organization. I think we have to begin to view these international organizations as really competitive arenas themselves, because that's the way our adversaries view them. And I think this is, again, another argument, right, for us working strongly, more closely together with allies and partners. Japan has been a great partner. They've brought a lot of the actions against the policies of the Chinese Communist Party forward within the World Trade Organization, for example. And I think there's room for plenty of cooperation with international organizations to get at our main problems. A lot of people were concerned with the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Agreement. And in fact, when I was in the administration, I was arguing to stay in. I just didn't see downside. Right? It wasn't the limits on emissions weren't mandatory. I felt like if we withdrew, that we would join a very small club of those who had not. Would not join it. We might lose influence in other areas. But after the president withdrew, I thought this, there might be a silver lining to this, in that I think the Paris Accord was dangerous because it was giving us a false sense of security about climate and environment. It wasn't going to address the main problems, which is the fact that right now that China and India are polluting the world, right? And so what we need is, we don't need any more sort of non-solutions to this problem. We need real solutions that are applicable not only in developed economies like ours, but are also attractive from an economic perspective around the world. The biggest reduction that we've seen, besides COVID, I guess, in carbon emissions, has been the conversion from coal to natural gas in the United States. Hey, that was an accident. or unanticipated at least, as a result of the fracking kind of revolution. But what it did is it created a free market incentive to convert those plants. That's the kind of solution we need. It's not going to be any one solution. And then, of course, we have all these interconnected issues right now that we need to work on internationally, because it's really the issues of climate, environment, energy, food security, water security. Those are all interconnected. And an area with and a country that I'm concerned about, because, I mean, we need it to succeed, is India. And I think this is a place where the United States, other nations, and India could partner together to really come up with, you know, with programs and efforts that are mutually reinforcing and get at that interconnected problem set. And so I appreciate your question. I think there is this idea, you know, that we're just stepping out of international organizations. I don't think that's the case. I think we're competing better within them. Some of them we've stepped out of. But I would favor, anyway, viewing these international organizations as competitive spaces. I'll tell you know who did a wonderful job as UN ambassador was Nikki Haley. I mean, you know, that she really advocated for U.S. interests very effectively. And so this maximum pressure campaign you see on North Korea wouldn't have been possible unless we got unprecedented UN Security Council sanctions approved. And so it's just an example of how an effective diplomatic effort can deliver very positive results within international organizations. I do think, though, I'll wrap up on this. There were unrealistic expectations of international organizations for many years. This term, even global governance, you know, I don't think it's ever going to work, right? I mean, unfortunately, China, Russia, you know, they're not waiting to be led, you know, by an international organization or an international consensus. There isn't going to be, I don't think, you know, a condominium of the great powers in a way that will allow for, you know, unfettered cooperation on our biggest problems. So I think we just have to be realistic about international organizations and maximize their potential. But also recognize that we have to compete within them.
Okay, we have a number of questions that all relate to the current pandemic and U.S. response. I'll start with the first one, and it looks like this is from a person who worked for a firm that worked with the U.S. government to develop a public-private partnership following SARS and the H1N1 epidemic, both of which originated in China. According to this person, one of the things that was prepared was a documented plan, for how the U.S. could respond to a pandemic, and that was provided, you know, sometime during a previous administration. Second part of that is, it's been reported that there was a pandemic office or a few staff positions within the National Security Council that was chartered with anticipating and responding to a pandemic. What happened to the plan document, and what happened to the people within the National Security Council who had been charged with doing this?
Okay, well, the effort to prepare for a pandemic really began back in the George W. Bush administration, and that effort really was based on President Bush, who was an avid reader, reading a book on pandemics, and gathering his staff. This is after 9/11. Everybody was really preoccupied with for this. So this is an effort to prepare that has gone across multiple administrations. And when we wrote the national security strategy, drafted it for the president in 2017. We put pandemic section into that national security strategy and drove a refinement of previous planning efforts that some of you may have seen was published in a plan in 2018 and approved by the president in 2018. So what did that call for? We called for three priority actions, and these were not new ideas, but they were sharpened during that first year of the Trump administration. The first priority action was to improve global surveillance and contain epidemics at their source. That was the first priority task. Well, how did it go? It didn't go well, right? It didn't go well, mainly because of the deception, dishonesty of the Chinese Communist Party. The ineffectiveness of the World Health Organization, and so forth. The second priority task was to innovate and to invest in really biomedical capabilities, so that we could rapidly develop therapies, but really rapidly develop the all important vaccines, rapid vaccine prototyping, and then to invest in the capacity to be able to manufacture, produce vaccines. At the scale necessary. I think there have been a lot of investment there. We'll see if that's been enough. But I mean, I think that's going to pay off. That investment over multiple administrations on innovating in the biomedical field, I think that's going to pay off. Now, on the back end of this, we have to ensure that innovation continues. We also have to assess the vulnerability of supply chains, which gets to the third point. The third point was to mobilize a response to a pandemic in the United States. And this is where we've seen, I think, our government fall short on implementation. And that has a lot to do with, you know, with the bureaucratic inertia within the administrative state. But it also has a lot to do with just the decentralized nature of our governance and our healthcare system. So I'm confident that we are catching up to this now, right? I mean, too late in some areas, right? Of course, you know, personal protective equipment, ventilators, you know, numbers of ICU beds, everything's we've been tracking right here. The pharmaceuticals and therapies in sufficient capacity and so forth. This is where we don't have good enough visibility of what capacity we have. And what the anticipated need is going to be, and then the ability to shift material, and I think also, though, obviously, people, right? People with the right skill sets ahead of that. So you're seeing the development on the fly of kind of a national dashboard to track all this. I think you're going to need, obviously, we're going to need to have a national stockpile that's adequate to shift. I think there has to be a degree of coordination across the country that doesn't have, you know, I mean, local officials and procurement efforts trying to outbid each other. There has to be an adjustment of supply chains such that they are not vulnerable to the coercion by the Chinese. As you've seen the reporting recently of China holding up shipment of personal protective equipment, for example. This is the same for pharmaceuticals. I co-authored an op-ed that will appear next week with one of my fellows here at the Hoover Institution, Scott Atlas, on reducing vulnerabilities to pharmaceutical supply chain disruption. And so we're going to learn from this. We will learn from this, and we will get better at it. And I think it's that third area where we've fallen down. And as anybody knows, you know, who's been in government or in business, you can come up with the best plan. But if it doesn't get implemented, it doesn't do any good. And I think this is what we've seen is a breakdown between the policy world and implementation of that policy, again, in that third key task of mobilizing the response. I think there are lots of opportunities, you know, within really maybe remissioning portions of the National Guard versus the Army Reserve. I'm working with a group of really volunteers on this problem set to people resources in advance of this through private sector initiatives, but then also to start to catalog the lessons learned here. The organization is called U.S. Civilian Corps, and the idea is that we need to have better visibility of people who are willing to volunteer in these times of crises and their skill sets and the ability then to mobilize them and match them to the need. In particular, we've been focused on people who have skill sets associated with crisis management, with care expertise, ability to build teams on the fly, to access complex supply chains. You know, an example is the Javits Center, right? You build it, right? Army Corps of Engineers builds it. You get nurses and doctors, right, who know how to care for patients. But, you know, how do you admit patients? How do you discharge patients? Where do you get the oxygen? Where do you get the pharmaceuticals? How do you establish the pharmacy? So what you need, and you saw these Army field hospitals fall in and get a lot of that done. But how do we develop that kind of ability? So there's a lot, obviously there's a lot of work that's going on the fly. I know there's an effort to capture lessons learned. Some of the people who were involved in this private sector effort of volunteers are now, you know, in government at either state level or at the national level working on this problem. And we're going to initiate an effort at Hoover here to identify what are these lessons. We're do that with a sense of urgency, right? Because what we want to do is try to identify what we can do if there is a second wave, right? So we're better prepared. But like any of these problem sets, I mean, we're going to learn and get better. And what we need to do is drive implementation once we identify. These can't be lessons observed. They have to be lessons that are really learned and recommendations based on those lessons that are actually implemented.
Okay. Got another question here. Given international views of how President Trump's actions have moved forward during the COVID-19 crisis, even including some of the comments made during yesterday's communication opportunity, and international comments following that, what do you think that will do to perceptions of America's leadership in the world over the next, say, 9 months?
Well, I think we are going to be in a competition, right, for, you know, how our response is perceived versus how China is trying to, and others are trying to put forward their response as, you know, as a model in an effort to gain influence. I think that, you know, I believe in the virtue of the United States, right? I believe that we have an advantage because the questioner, all of us, we get to criticize our government. We get to criticize our president. And therefore we have a corrective available to us within our democratic system. In these authoritarian regimes, they can't do that. They can't do that. It's either, I mean, actually, after the Chinese Communist Party mishandled this, Xi Jinping and the party actually mandated praise for Xi Jinping and ordered people to go onto social media and extol, you know, the virtues of the party and the wise handling of the crisis and so forth. So I think we just ought to be grateful. You know, if the questioner or anybody's disappointed with the president, hey, I think we ought to be grateful for the opportunity that we can criticize our government. And provide that government with feedback. I do think that, you know, there is a tendency these days to make everything about President Trump. You know, it's just, you know, and of course I think he enjoys that, right? He probably enjoys that himself. But you know, obviously this problem and these other challenges that we're facing internationally, you know, transcend, you know, even President Trump. So I think it's important for us to not fall into what I think has been a trap almost of this increased polarization around partisan politics and either supporting a President Trump or against President Trump or for this person, against this person. I think whenever we can focus more on what we can agree on and focus more on understanding better the problems that we have to overcome, we're going to be able to get a lot done. And I think what you've seen is, you know, despite the partisanship that we've seen in our government, I think it's been kind of refreshing. I mean, I think we ought to at least acknowledge when something positive happens, is the way that the executive and legislative branch have worked together to get some legislation implemented. I mean, it really breakneck speed, right? Now, it's not going to be adequate to get through this crisis, but anyway, our government is functioning. I think as vitriolic as it's been at times, you know, with the banter between governors and federal government, you know, how you see some of the governors coming together, there is a cooperative relationship going on between the federal government and the states. This has been the weakness, right? This coordination, this ability, being able to shift resources. So anyway, I'm not trying to be Pollyannish about this, but I think that there is this kind of soundtrack that we're hearing, you know, that feeds the polarization. But the actions that our government is taking, and by our government, I mean from, you know, local to state to federal, is catching up to this problem.
Okay, I'd like to change direction a little bit. This week, apparently, there was increased concern over Iranian naval activity, particularly in the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf region. We've got a couple of questions here. What is your opinion on President Trump's direction to shoot down gunboats and destroy them? And what potential risks could exist if we do that?
Okay, first what I'd like to do is place this in context, right? So I think a lot of times when we see actions by Iran, we forget really two things. Okay, what is the nature of the regime? What is driving this behavior? And then the second is, you know, how does this fit in to really what is a 40-year-long proxy war against the United States, Israel, the Arab monarchies, you know, and the West broadly. Once Iran came under renewed economic pressure as the U.S. really implemented additional sanctions even before withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, and then the sanctions being re-implemented after the withdrawal of the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, I think the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei had really three choices. Right, the first choice would be that he would welcome a renewed negotiations. He would reduce, you know, or stop or dramatically reduce his support for terrorist organizations and proxy forces across the region and show good faith, you know, to renegotiate. Okay, well, that wasn't going to happen, right? That because it cuts against the ideology of the regime. The second choice that he would have is try to just wait out Donald Trump, right? And wait for, you know, a new administration to come in, work with the Europeans to try to circumvent the U.S. sanctions. Well, that didn't work, right? Because, I mean, a business given the choice, you can do business with Iran or you can do business with the United States. They're gonna pick the United States. And then, of course, the economic crisis that in Iran, I would say, I'm sure of it, is caused primarily by the corruption of that regime and the fact that the Bunyads, which are associated with the clerical leaders and their families, are really the beneficial owners of these companies in Iran, as well as leaders within the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps. And they run these criminal patronage networks, and they apply the profits from licit and illicit activity, including narcotics trafficking, to their, you know, to their proxy wars and their support for terrorists and insurgents across the region. So I would put, when the economy in Iran is failing, the first thing people say is, well, you know, it's because of the sanctions. No, actually, it's because of a corrupt regime, and also a regime that deserves its status as a pariah state and therefore deserves its economic and diplomatic isolation. And so we have put – and the third option is to escalate, and try to extract, you know, coerce from the United States and the West, concessions, relaxation of sanctions, and so forth. Well, I mean, that's what they've chosen to do. And that's what they chose to do in Iraq when they attacked our embassy and they attacked our soldiers in Iraq. That resulted in the January 3rd strike that killed Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, which I believe was the righteous use of violence against an enemy of the United States who had American blood on his hands, including really a hand in the death of over 600 U.S. servicemen and women in Iraq by the, you know, through the Iranian training and supply of proxy militias in Iraq. So, what happened since then? And this is what we've kind of lost focus on, right? Because of COVID, there have been almost 20 attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq since then. And I think what what Iran is trying to do there in Iraq is elicit reprisals from the United States that actually inflict casualties on Iraqis other than these Shia proxy forces. So then Iran can galvanize more support in more Iraqi factions to ask for the U.S. to leave Iraq. You have Iran also running the sustained campaign of political subversion within Iraq by capturing state institutions and functions. You saw that with Adnan al-Zurfri, who was a good man, was nominated for the prime ministership after the people demanded, the Iraqi that Abdel al-Dahmadi, the prime minister, stepped down. A lot of those protests were anti-Iranian protests, right? Protesting Iranian influence within Iraq. Now, Mustafa al-Qadhimi is the new recommended prime minister. He's not an Iranian puppet by any means. He was the head of their intelligence service, right? I think what you're seeing now is Iraqis are fed up with Iranian influence within Iraq. You just saw recently, last couple days, right? Iran said, hey, open your borders, because Iran is desperate for more economic activity. Well, of course, Iran, which is riven with COVID, because they didn't shut down travel to China, because China is, you know, is one of their two patrons along with Russia. Iraq said, no, we're not going to open our borders. So I think what you're seeing is the fact that an Iraq that is aligned with Iran is unnatural. What's going on in the Gulf is part of this escalation, in really, I think, an effort to go with the United States into strikes that they can then portray itself as a victim. These maneuvers against our ships are very aggressive, and it's really impossible to tell what the intention is. Oh, is it just more harassment, or is this an actual attack? So I think what the president did by saying, hey, listen, you know, if you behave this way in an aggressive way against our warships, we're going to blow you out of the water. I think that's great. You know, I mean, I think he's supporting commanders who will make the right decisions, who are trained to make these decisions. I think Iran is making a big miscalculation, though. I think they believe that in an election year, they can escalate, and then escalate in a way that doesn't incur any cost on them. And I think they believe that we'll only respond maybe outside of Iran. I don't know. I think the Soleimani strike communicated to them that when these attacks occur, we know what the return address is, right? We know what the return address is. And I think when you look at the broad pattern of U.S. policy toward Iran, it's generally been one of conciliation, us trying to conciliate with the Iranians. If you look at really after the hostage crisis, even before the hostage crisis, Brzezinski traveled to Algeria to try to meet with the leadership of the revolution. You know, after the hostage crisis, President Reagan thought, hey, if we sell them some desperately needed weapons, you know, maybe they'll release hostages. Maybe they'll work with us more. What do we get out of that? We get the Lebanon bombings in 83, right? And our embassy and the Marine barracks, right? That didn't work. Then you have the effort under George H.W. Bush, where he said, hey, goodwill can beget goodwill. He thought maybe there could be an opening to Iran. Of course, that's when Iran goes global with its terrorist network, assassinations in Europe, bombings of a synagogue and a Jewish community center in Argentina, the blowing up of a Panamanian airline, right? So that's what you got after conciliation. Then under the Clinton administration, you have Khobar Towers bombing that occurs against a U.S. Air Force barracks in Saudi Arabia, kills 17 Americans in that bombing. And then we don't do a reprisal because, hey, there's a new president, Khatami. Like, he's a librarian. He must be nicer. You know, let's have a conciliatory effort. Well, he's the shop window for the real regime, the supreme leader and the IRGC, just as Rouhani is now and just as his foreign minister, Zarif, was. Even the Bush administration, you know, tried to cooperate with Iran on Afghanistan, on Iraq. What do we get? We get 600 dead American servicemen and women in southern Iraq. You see, even with President Trump, there was an effort. Of course, the Obama administration doubled down on conciliation under the JCPOA. So, hey, I just don't think conciliation works with the regime. And I think this strategy of maximum pressure is the right strategy. I don't think there should be any let up in sanctions at all. And I think the purpose of this strategy should be hey, force Iran to make a choice. Hey, do you want to be a nation state or do you want to be a terrorist organization? If you're going to be a terrorist organization, you're going to be treated like a terrorist organization. So I think it is a time of increasing tension. There's no doubt about it. I think whatever we do in response shouldn't play into their hands. I think in the long term, what we're doing is going to work. But I think the president, you know, hopefully deterred them from doing something stupid that could lead to an escalation and unnecessary loss of life. Because I think they're going to, you know, if they threaten the United States again, if they attack us and inflict casualties on us again, I think they're going to get more than they bargained for.
Okay, I think we've run out of time, and you know, I'm sorry we did not have.
Can we end on a happy note? Can we end on a happy note? Do you think, John?
Okay. I just want to say. please come up with something happy.
Okay, I'll tell you. I think this is obviously we are in a dire health crisis right now. We have many challenges across the world, but I think that what we should see from how we are responding as a society, when we look at our healthcare workers, when we look at our first responders, when we look at the acts of kindness you see going on across America and the resiliency that we're showing, okay, I think we should be tremendously proud of who we are. We should restore confidence in our democratic principles and institutions and processes. And what I hope happens is we recognize that these big issues that we're facing, they transcend partisan politics. And that if we have the kind of discussions like you foster in the World Affairs Council, you know, that we will come together as a society. So just to conclude, I want to say thank you for the privilege of being with you. Thank you for what the World Affairs Council does. And it was a real privilege to be with you, John. Thank you.
And thank you. And thanks to all those who submitted questions, even though we didn't get a chance to deal with them. I know this is a bit of an experiment. We have a lot of uncertainty here in South Carolina, just as we do in the rest of the world. I really appreciate all of you who took the time to sign in and listen. And as we have mentioned before, one of the primary things we try to do as an organization is to provide a broad perspective on issues that are of importance to the United States. And I think we heard a very valuable set of impressions today. I appreciate your attention, and I'm looking forward to you and others signing in next week when we do another live webcast with the current ambassador from Estonia, who will probably have a very different perspective from most of the people that we've had in the past couple of years. So thank you very much. I appreciate it, and stay healthy, stay safe.